Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Ellie?
Hey, is this Andrew?
Yes.
Hey, it's Bree.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So you managed to get all your shit taken care of?
Do what?
I said, did you manage to get all your shit taken care of?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I did. I had like 15 show shirts to embroider, like a ton of embroidery on them. And this guy's a really good customer of mine. He's been with me for years, and he wanted them before a sale this week. I literally had them for like a week on top of my normal production timeline's about a month. So I apologize again.
No, you're good. Like, I get it. I train and show horses for a living. I get it.
Which I'm surprised you don't drink.
Well, I'm very tempted. I'm not. I mean, I don't start at 9 o'clock in the morning, but. I might have one down again. I don't mind a drink down again, but I'm more of a cigar guy.
Really?
Uh-huh.
My dad smoked cigars my whole life growing. He still smokes them today.
I used to smoke, and I smoked a lot of cigarettes, like way too many. And I managed to quit smoking the cigarettes, and when I worked for Rick Darling at Darling Ranch, he got me hooked on whiskey and cigars. Yes, so bad. Have our little deals.
Ain't nothing wrong with that. Some people get really into it. Like, it's, I mean, they can spend some money on a cigar. Some of them are very expensive.
Yeah, they are. They can't be. So
hold on a second.
Yeah.
Where's this accent from?
So originally my wife and I are from England.
No way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're both from England. My wife and I, my first two children. My eldest two, one was born in Germany while we were working there, and the other one was born in England, and then my younger two were both born over here.
Holy cow. So what made you, or what age did you come to America, and what for?
Yeah. I was 18 when I first moved out here.
Uh-huh.
I've been showing all around horses in England. In the youth stuff, and I was offered a job. One of the judges that was over there judging had said, oh, you know, hey, you ever want to come out and ride, spend the summer, come ride with us, you know, learn a little bit, you know, we'll happily take you. And at the time, I think I was probably around 16 when my mom was like, absolutely not, you're not going. You know, and I grew up in the horse industry. My mom train show jump dressage horses, and my dad and my brother were both jockeys.
Oh, wow.
And my mom was like, absolutely not. You can't go without a driver's license. Well, I got my driver's license. I did 18 months almost at college. Turned 18, I called Pete Bowling. And I said, hey, does that job offer still stand? And he says, yeah. I said, good. I'll be there next week. So I got on a plane and left England at 18 and moved to Gainesville, Texas to go and work for Bryant Pace.
Holy cow.
And I stayed out here for a while. Rachel, who was my wife, we'd been dating. She ended up coming out there. She got to where she needed something else to do. She was the same age as me, a couple months older. And Jim Babcock was like, hey, I need another lope rider. I need a cutting assistant. I was like, hey, I know a girl.
Yeah.
And he's like, really? I was like, yeah, she can write. I was like, she can write. She's written this, written that, blah, blah. And he's like, get in here. So I called Rachel and I said, hey, you want to come to Texas? Come hang out here. And she's like, heck yeah. I was like, book you a plane ticket. Get out here. I got you a job.
So she grew up in horses just like you did too. You guys
not quite as in depth, but we met at college. We both went to Equine College at Cambridge, and so we met there, and we dated on and off. But so she lands in Dallas, and I forgot she was coming, so I was like 4 hours late picking her up at the airport. Because I totally forgot what day she was coming in. Yeah, this story gets way better. And I finally
got her back. Obviously, she forgave you.
No, I don't think she has, actually. She still tells people that I left at the airport. And we get back to the ranch, and I show her around, and I show her everything. And I was like, tomorrow morning, you know, you'll meet Kyle. She was going to go work for Kyle Cox, cutting trainer, at the time. And she's like, okay, but before we do that, would you show me how to put one of these saddles on? And it dawned on me, one, I had never seen this girl sit on a horse. Two, she had never been within 100 feet of a cow. And three, she had no idea how to strap a Western saddle to a horse's back. So, like 11 o'clock at night. At 11 o'clock at night, we're out there at the barn, and I'm like, okay, when you come out here in the morning, this is what you're going to have to do.
Holy cow.
And they tortured her so bad. They gave her an old gelding, and I told them she'd come out of a racing barn. So they gave her this old gelding. They told her she was going to be turned back. They gave her an old gelding. They put an old Price McLaughlin reining saddle on it, and they gave her a loping hackamore and like, okay, you're going to learn to turn back. And she spent 4 months being screamed at in a cutting pen and told to read the cow. And she's like, I have no idea what that means.
Holy cow. Well, she made it work, obviously, but that's one way to get thrown into it.
Yeah. So then... Oh, shoot, we left, let's see, we went back home.
Well, wait, hold on, did you work for the same place that she was at, too?
Yeah, she was in the cutting barn, and I was riding the reiners and the cow horses, so.
Oh, so they had both out there.
Yeah, so this was back when Jim Babcock was flying high. He had Smart Chickalina, and he had Alon's Playboy, and, Pete Bolin was the ranch manager out there, and they had Master Jay, and they had that paint horse of Smokey Pritchett's. And Bryant Pace had been riding the Rainers, and then he left to go work for Kim Sloan. And Morgan Libet came in and took over, and we switched more towards the cow horse deal. And Kyle Cox was in there training the cutters. So I was there in the switchover between Jason Clark and Kyle Cox on the cutting side, and you know, Bryant Pace and Morgan Libet on the cow side, and you know, Bryant was training the reiners, and then he left and Morgan took over, and it kind of switched a little more towards the cow horse. So I was riding reiners and cow horses, and you know, my wife was riding the cutters, and we got married while we lived out there in Gainesville, and that was There's a while ago.
Holy cow. Now, did you ever go back and visit home any at all, or did they come visit you? Or?
No, we did a little bit. I mean, we weren't here that long back then. You know, we were here on, like, we did the whole visa waiver thing because we were really just work experience kids, interns, so more than anything. And when we left, we did a couple of years in Europe, and then we bought a place in England, and we set up on our own over there training all-around horses, halter, western pleasure, trail, you know, youth kids, amateur, all-around, that kind of stuff, doing a lot of quarter horse stuff. And We just found that the season is so short over there, and we struggled so bad keeping customers in between the end of September and the beginning of April. So it was feast or famine. You know, and we
well. So hold on. Do you think like it's the industry over there? Is it way less than it is compared over here? Like it's bigger over here than it is over there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, okay. There is no comparison. No comparison. And the cat, you know, mainland Europe, Germany, France, little more advanced. You know, the biggest problem with the Western style, the Western discipline, that even if you just think you're all around type horse.
Yeah.
There's such a stigma around it in England that you're playing cowboy. So, you know, you've got to think England is very much horse racing, hunter jumpers, show jumping, dressage, you know.
Got you, yeah.
So we were trying to do that. We tried and tried. We had a pretty decent business going, and we were pretty successful. But we were online one day. I think I'd been watching the Reign of Fertility or the Derby. Well, I think it was the Derby. I've been watching the Derby online on the live feed. And I saw an ad for somebody advertising for an assistant trainer. And these people were in Tennessee. And I was like, screw it. I'm going to apply for it. And I talked to my wife about it. And she was like, whatever, man. She goes, I'll follow you. You know, you think we want to do that? Let's do it. The kids are young. We now, if we're going to do something stupid like this, now's the time to do it.
Right.
No. You know, the children were, the two oldest were both very little. And I applied for this job. Ultimately ended up getting it. So then had to figure out selling my place, selling all my stuff, packing up my wife and two small kids and moving them 5,500 miles to Tennessee to go and work for Tammy Hutton at Hildale Farm.
And how long did this process take?
It took a while because, we did it properly, did the whole, apply, get an attorney and get the visa stuff. And, and luckily Charlie Hutton was an amazing man and has an amazing mind on him and was able to help with that so much. And Tammy was patient enough to wait on us to get it done. But it took about 5-6 months to get the visa rolling in at the UK end and get approval.
That's probably an ordeal. That's an ordeal.
So this was, back in 2007. Obviously now we're permanent residents here in the U.S. Half of my family's on green cards, the other half of them are citizens. But in the course of that 16 years, we probably spent $50,000 staying legal.
Holy cow!
But the system works. The immigration system, a lot of people moan about it and complain and bitch and cry. The immigration system actually works if it is followed. What doesn't work is the open border bullshit. I mean, that's getting into a whole other can of worms. But the actual immigration process is fine. It is, there's nothing wrong with the immigration process as long as it is followed.
Right.
And like we came in and the first year we did understand how the U.S. tax system worked. So from 2009 onwards, we figured it out and we, if you behave yourself and you pay your taxes and you contribute, it's all good. It's all good. But there's a lot of people that try to buck the system and, those are the ones that annoy me. Because it's like, damn it.
I try not to. I associate all of that with politics, and I try to just steer clear of that.
See, my wife is very up on the politics. Me, not so much. I derive all of my information from her, and when I go, that sounds kind of shady as shit, I'll go ahead and research a little bit myself. But normally I find that she's right, and I tend to shut up.
He's a smart man.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I still train horses for a living.
Well, she could bring up the whole you left me at the airport for 4 hours.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. I mean, there's way more stuff than that too. I mean, that's like a minor detail.
So let me ask you this. I do know I had a couple of customers, like reigning customers, and reigning stud customers. They said that reigning was big over there in
Italy, Germany, Belgium, Holland. Yes, it is. It is huge.
Oh, but not like England. England got you.
No, but in that tiny little island that's, you know, on the same latitude as Canada that sits off in the Atlantic, yeah, no, not so much there.
That's wild, but it makes sense, though, for it to be more like English concentrated.
It is.
In Western.
It, very much so. And, you know, and we were, at that time, we were young and dumb enough to go, you know, I found that the reining horses was really where I really felt like I wanted to go. Yeah. And we've been showing halter horses and we've been, you know, Western Pleasure and stuff like that. And riding some English horses on the side. And I mean, even to this day, my mom still thinks this is a stupid thing to do with horses, but she's dressage and show jumping, you know? Huh. So my mom will come out here and visit and be like, why? Why do you do that? But, you know, we decided that if we were going to do it, we wanted to do it properly. And yeah. there was only one way to do it properly.
Yeah.
And that was to go to where the heart of it was and try to learn from somebody. And what, like we said, you know, we'd much rather go 5 to 10 years and go, look, that didn't work. We tried.
Yeah.
Then get 10 years down the road and say, I wish I had.
Yeah. Now, when y'all were at the barn in Texas, is that when you kind of decided, when you kind of looked at, because you were like right there with cutters and reiners, is that when you kind of looked and said, okay, reining is where I'm going to go?
Yeah. And, you know, and there's a few people to hold accountable for that too. You know, so that was when Smart Chickalina got his first $1 million sire deal. And so we went to the fraternity, and there was actually a picture floating around. Craig Johnson just reposted a picture from that night.
On YouTube from 1999, the
NRA yes.
$1 million sire induction ceremony.
Yes. So there's a picture that goes along with that. I'm trying to find it because it's one of those that there's actually myself, there we go, Oliver Stein. I'm gonna see if I can't send this to you real quick.
Okay.
I sent you this picture that was put up. So in this picture, you've got Craig Johnson sitting on Smart Chickalina, Jim Babcock standing next to him, holding the cup and the roses and everything. That young goofy looking son of a bitch in the purple shirt is me. CT Babcock standing behind Jim. Then I don't remember the Mexican guy's name. Then you've got Ollie Stein, who is still in Germany training reiners. Then that is my wife next to Ollie. And then the kid in the red shirt is Hubert Huell. And Hubert now lives in Canada and is training reining horses in Canada. He was a Dutch national. So you had two Brits, a Dutchman and a German, all pretty much living together at Babcock's at the time, and all of us were like 18, 19 years old. You know, and I mean, you talk about some stories of those guys. The Dutch guy was the guy that put a can of beans in the microwave because he wanted to warm up supper.
Oh, wow. I bet that
ended
up well.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's where it all started. So, like, you know, the likes of Craig Johnson was one of the big influences for me early on. You know, Mike Moser was right across the road. Morgan Libet lived just down the road. We lived next door to Dragon A. there was just so much going on there in that area that for me, the Rainers was where it was at. And, yeah. You know, and I, you know, I worked for Bryant, and Bryant was very crude and to the point, would dish out a cussing pretty easily. And, but I still enjoyed it. Even though I maybe didn't enjoy Bryant so much, I enjoyed the horses.
Well, I mean, you know, sometimes they got a tough love, I guess is what you want to call it.
Yeah, and I deserved most of my cousins I got. I guarantee you that. I pretty much every ass chewing I got was more than likely deserved.
Well, y'all were young. I mean, you were young when you first moved over here. So, I mean, not only were yes. you working in a completely different country, but you were still young. You had to go through and do the dumb crap that we all do when we're young.
We had to make our mistakes. I made most of them. it was more often than not me that was being like, hey, what the hell?
So when you were staying at this farm, they had obviously a couple of young guys helping them, and you were, they had a couple of different assistant trainers and different people that were helping?
Oh, shoot, yeah, way back then. So, you know, back then, Pete Boland was managing the ranch and doing the breeding management stuff, and obviously Jim was overseeing anything. CT at the time was running the big truck and trailer and buying hay and running up and down the country doing stuff like that, driving horses here, there, and everywhere. And then you had a cutting trainer, an assistant cutting trainer, a reining trainer, an assistant reining trainer. At one point, there were three or four guys breaking colts. I mean, I think my first year there, when I first got there, it was Billy Hayes, Mickey Sorpe from Germany, and then myself. We were all starting colts, and I want to say we started close to 100 head between Holy January God. And April.
Jesus Christ. I mean, y'all had a lot of horses running in and out.
Oh, yeah. And we had, you know, we had the training barns, we had two main training barns. Then we had the stud barn, the show barn, the men motel. And a lot of the two-year-olds, we rotated. we'd get them going, put 10 days on them and give them to the cutting trainer, give them to the reining trainer and their assistants. There would be horses tied to horse walkers and fences and in makeshift pens and living out with the cattle and tied in the cutting pen. There would be horses everywhere.
You've seen this. I mean, you've been around this for long enough to answer. I mean, do you think that the industry has shot up recently, or do you think it's stayed the same?
No, it's shot up. You know, and it hasn't just shot up. It's improved. It's evolved. What now, where the days are gone where you could take a pretty nice horse, you know, what was a pretty nice horse back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, a 72 and a half, 73 type horse, you could go win a lot of stuff on him. But horsepower itself has improved. The breeding program has improved. The horsemanship that is, and horse care and horse husbandry that's coming in now over the last 10, 15 years is phenomenal. You know, what the thought that people are putting into their horses, their programs, their barns, their feeding, their nutrition, the horseshoers, it's only improved the whole industry. And I believe that through the reining, the cow horse, the cutting, the Western pleasure, you know, specifically the performance events as far as the three Western performance events, it's exploded. And a lot of it is because, you know, honestly, with the internet and live feed and people have access to information, you know, it's so much easier to put it out there in front of everybody with the likes of YouTube, Facebook,
right.
Twitter, Instagram, you know, and that brings in more people. Obviously brings in more people. And then here more recently with the Run for a Million, the Teton Ridge deal, the American Performance Horseman, you know, it's, yes, I think, and I think it's going to continue to grow. I hope it continues to grow.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing for me is that the amount of horsemanship, the level of horsemanship that is creeping in, where even your lower level guys are taking so much better care of their horses.
Yeah. Well, like you just said, the information is a little more easily accessible. Not that it's necessarily right, but it's easier for somebody to learn better
right.
and do better.
You know, I mean, you go back 30 years. You know, if you grew up riding 4-H and running barrels or whatever, you
yeah.
probably would never get exposed to the reining or the cow horse unless you bought the Quarter Horse News or the AQHA Journal.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And you might look at that and go, oh, yeah, oh, look at those guys. But you carry on. Whereas now it's all online, and in 30 seconds, you can pull up a run from anywhere in the world with anybody you can think of and watch them show a horse and be like, huh, that's kind of cool. Or I can, you know, I've got a lot of friends back home. I mean, shoot, I grew up playing rugby, cricket, soccer, field hockey. I mean, I've got a lot of guys.
Wait, whoa, what's cricket? You threw me for a loop there. You're going to have to explain what cricket is at some point.
it's kind of like baseball, just different.
Oh, okay.
It's like a British Australian version of baseball, I guess.
Oh, okay. But I'm gonna have to Google that later.
it'll probably just confuse you more watching it. You'll be like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Why is there two of them running around? But
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
But that's the thing. I mean, I can, you know, I can have friends from back home from when I was a kid say, hey, what, you know, what's been going on? What have you been up to? And I can shoot them a video of me showing something 3 weeks ago, and they're like, yeah, that's cool. What is that? What are you doing? But the thing is it's so much more accessible. It's easier to find.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, before, if you didn't have access to the information or know a way to get access, you know, if you didn't know somebody that got the Quarter Horse Journal or the Quarter Horse News or the Rainer magazine, you were never going to see it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Because, I mean, you can probably remember this too. Clinics, when clinics weren't even around, people used to never even do clinics, you know?
No.
And
what? So my introduction to Western horses came from a demonstration in England done by a guy called Bob Mayhew, who was a British guy, and actually Morgan Libbett. And I didn't realize this at the time. I was probably only 6 or 7 years old. But they did a demonstration, and specifically a reining demonstration for a big group of riding school instructors from the Association of British Riding Schools. This is way back in like 86, 87. That was my introduction. I had never, I mean, other than in a Western movie,
right?
You know, Blazing Saddles, had I ever seen a Western saddle? You know, so other than watching John Wayne and those things, I'd never seen a Western saddle. I thought all cowboy horses rode around like that. You know, I thought that's what it was. So, but that only happened by chance because my mom taught and was a riding instructor. She went to this thing. I happened to be off school sick. So I got drug along too, and I was like, I want to ride that horse. And that was where it started for me. But had I not have gone to that demonstration, I may not have known anything about what a rein horse was, what a western horse was, because I would never have gotten into that avenue.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I mean, the information is just, so everything is so easily accessible, and you know, people can look for things that spark their interest and desire.
The problem is the people only look for what they think they want to look for. So, you know, we have all this information accessible to us, yet still people only search so far. I mean, I had it today. I've got a horse advertised on Facebook for sale, and I've had a certain lady comment 3 times on a post about this horse, and I had to actually put a comment on her 3rd comment today saying, look, I sent you a message 7 hours ago with all the information. You have chosen not to read the message. Don't be a dumbass.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that goes through this.
Well, I have a rule. I use Facebook purely for shameless self-promotion. I mean, that and comedy relief. I can't blame you. I have a rule. Whereas if normally when people comment and they say things like it just says price, or it just has a dollar sign, or it just says info, I'm like, bite me. I don't need to sell that thing that bad. Especially when I put in the post, please call or text for more information. Now, I don't mind if they message me, because 9 times out of 10, those that are serious will call or message. The ones that comment, they've got $2,500 to spend. And I'm not knocking what they're trying to look for, but it's probably not going to be what I got.
Well, I mean, common sense ain't very common. It's just a matter. It's just the principle of that whole ad says, please message or call.
And there's nothing wrong with politeness and common decency.
That's scary. That's sacred these days. Like, that's so rare. You don't even when you see it, you question it. You're like, are you sure?
Yeah. You're like, okay, you're up to something.
Yeah.
That we have all this information literally at our fingertips now, whereas, you know, way back when, even back in the mid-90s, you didn't have it. If you didn't have access to those avenues, if you didn't have somebody, you know, somebody that maybe gave you a Rainer magazine or gave you a Quarter Horse Journal, you know, you were never going to see that stuff. You know,
I completely agree, because I mean, I can even relate a little bit. When I was riding, I didn't do rein or anything like that. But I mean, you know, if you wanted to learn how to do something, you didn't have the internet. You either found a barn or figured it out yourself.
Right. You see, and the thing is, you know, back then when I was a kid in England, you know, my mom trained show jump dressage, had a riding school. My dad and my brother were jockeys. Western riding? What is wrong with you? Well, you want to be a weekend cowboy? What, you know, I mean, and so that was something that was extremely frowned upon.
Oh, I could see that. Yeah.
You know,
now your dad was jock, I'm assuming, racehorses, right?
Yes. Yes.
So that's the biggest thing over there is racehorses and
racing. Yes. Racehorses. And then you've got your 3-day event horses. Yeah, your steeplechases, you know, your point-to-pointers, and then you've got your dressage and your show jumping, you know, and pony club. I liken it to the 4-H kind of thing. Pony club will do their games. They'll do some pole bending and stuff like that. But, you know, the pony club, again, it's all English. It's all derived from it's heading towards dressage, or show jumping, or eventing, or, you know, into that kind of area. the Western community, if you like, over there is so small and tight-knit, which isn't a bad thing, but the biggest problem is you don't have the facilities very much. Facilities, you know, you don't have, very few people have ground to ride a reiner on.
Right.
Because it's specialized. They all have, you know, dressage or show jumping ground. And, you know, now there's a few guys that did come along in the last 15 years or so, but they were also specialized Western barns.
Yeah.
But if you didn't know about them, well, you didn't know about them.
Yeah. Do you think that it coming up over there over the last 10 to 15 years, like you just said, do you think that's because of it kind of exploding in America and people are wanting to migrate over here? So instead, England maybe said, look, we need to provide this type of...
I can, you know, that's kind of a tough one for me because I... having come from it, part of the reason I left was I felt like it wasn't going forwards.
Yeah.
At the rate that I wanted to go forwards.
Yeah.
And although I think they've progressed over there, I think there's still quite a, you know, for lack of a better word, a stigma around it. And I think. Yeah, a lot of the guys have gone over to Europe and been successful over there too. But the biggest problem over there is it's an island, you know.
Yeah.
And I think because it's an island and you have to cross the channel to get to the bigger horse shows, you know. And I think that's why it's bigger in mainland Europe, in the likes of Italy, Belgium, France, Germany, Holland. I think that's why it's bigger over there, and not so much in England. And
yeah, just
tried.
For the sheer.
I mean, yeah, and I'm gonna, you know, those guys have really tried to promote it over there, but the problem is it's just the fraction of people that want to do it just is not big enough to make it really big over there.
Yeah. So when you came, all right. So when after you guys came over here, went back, and then you came back and you stayed, you went to Tennessee. Are you guys still in Tennessee, or did you go back to Texas at all?
So, long story short, we were in Tennessee, and then Tammy moved that whole ranch, the Hilldale farm. She moved it from Tennessee to Kentucky, built a fabulous, beautiful facility in West Kentucky. And then we've been there a while, and, you know, it was one of those deals that was, you know, time to move on. They were having a big dispersal sale. I rode some pleasure horses for a little while, and I went and worked in north of Missouri. Now, I can tell you right now, I am never going north of the Mason-Dixon line ever again. That is bullshit.
I was fixing to say, I've spoken to quite a few horse people up there. And when I stay up there, like those upper states, and they kind of say the same thing. It's hard.
I spent one winter north of Columbia, Missouri, and I don't ever want to go back that way again past July. If I ever move again, I'm moving south. But anyways, I lived up there for a while, had decent bit of success up there working for those people, but our views were different on what we wanted. I wanted to go horse show a lot more, and they had a pretty good breeding program. We're raising some nice horses, and they wanted to go more in the sale route, you know, fitting these things and sending them through 2-year-old sales and maybe having a show horse, whereas I was very show orientated, and I was like, you know, I really want to be doing the fraternities and the derbies and stuff like that. And, you know, we kind of locked horns a little bit, and it was kind of funny. I liked those guys, and I enjoyed their horses. And actually, that year I won a world. I was top 10, NRHA top 10 in 3 categories on one of their horses. I'd made the Open Derby finals. I was leading the novice horse level 1, I think, at one point. And we were at the Derby. We're at the NRHA Derby in Oklahoma City in June. And Bryant Pace had just taken the lead off of me in the world standings for the novice horse. And he was riding a horse owned by some Japanese customers. And I beat him in the first leg of novice horse at Oklahoma City. And he came up to me and he's like, "Why don't you just come work for me?" I was like, "Bryant, I worked for you once before. I remember what it was like. I'm not doing it again."
Wow.
We were at the fraternity. So fast forward to November, we're at the fraternity. And Bryant Pace had left. Mike Boyle, working for Darling Ranch, made the open finals on Easy Little Lanes, which was owned by Darling Ranch. Mike offers me a job. And I was like, and he's like, "It's okay. Bryant's left."
There you go.
So I went home for the fraternity and I mulled it over and I thought about it and I stewed on it and I was like, I don't know. So I take a week's vacation right there around Christmas. My wife and I go down to Kentucky to visit with some friends. And I get a phone call from a friend of mine. And he says, "Have you seen your website?" I was like, "No." "Oh, why?" He's like, "Think you got fired, bud." I'm like, "What?" Sure shit. I look at my website and it says on the front page, "Hiring new head trainer." And I was like, "Well, I guess I am fired." So we were just, we were just a few miles from Darling Ranch. So I jumped in the truck and I drove down there and visited with Mike Boyle. And I spent the next 10 years back in West Kentucky working for Rick Darling, you know, with Mike Boyle. And then my wife and I bought a piece of ground out here in Texas, and we moved to Texas 5 years ago. So we have come full circle.
You have, but you're working for yourself. You're not working for nobody else.
Yes, we work for ourselves now. And, you know, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, lots of these guys, they give up too easily, I think. There's a lot to be said for working for yourself. But there's a lot to be said for really, truly spending the time with somebody. Like, I've gone out on my own 3 times and gone back to being an assistant trainer because I wasn't ready. I didn't know enough. I didn't have everything, all the pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
You know, because there's a lot. There's far more to it than just feeding them and riding them.
Right. Well, yeah, of course.
You know, you've got to have your training side of it down, for one. And I truly believe that takes, you know, 7 to 10 years for somebody to really get that figured out. To go from being a competent rider to being a more than competent, disciplined horse trainer. 7 to 10
right.
years working with people. You know, and once you've got that figured out, you've then got to learn the customer aspect to it. If you're going to train, if you're going to coach, train horses for non-pros and youth kids and rookies and green riders, you've got to understand the coaching. And you've got to be able to look at your coaching, your riders the same as your horses. You know, some of your horses, they're linebackers. They can be yelled at. They can be screamed at. They can be pushed. They can be driven. Some of them are chess players. You raise your voice, they fold. They can't take it. And, you know, figuring out which horses and which people are like that, and then trying to match them up. You know, and it becomes quite entertaining when you've got a horse that's a linebacker and you've got a chess player of a rider, and you're like, okay, how am I going to get these two to figure that shit out?
Well, I was fixing to say, it's probably hard to get to know somebody enough to be able to figure them out for a horse. Like, you know what I mean? Like, when you can't just meet somebody off the blue and go, okay, well, I got the perfect horse for you. You know, it's going to take a second. To really
right.
be able
and,
to match that.
It does. And, you know, it sometimes it's very difficult because you'll have a customer. Like I've been fortunate. I've got some customers that have been with me for, 10 plus years. And quite often we'll be like, somebody will be like, hey, would you help me find a horse? And I'm like, yes, I can help you find a horse. What are you looking for? Like, give me your checklist.
Yeah.
What is it? Is it, and I that's one of my biggest things. I want a checklist of what you think you want, and I want a budget of what you are willing to spend. And I don't ask for the budget to be nosy. I ask for the budget so that I can count out anything that's above.
Right.
I don't want to muddy the water. And I don't want to make somebody wish they could spend more. If somebody says to me, like, my budget is $25,000, then I'm going to go try and find something that close to checks off all of their boxes that's around that 20 to 25 range. Then that way we're looking at comparable horses. We're apples to apples.
Yeah.
Whereas if I say, hey, I found this other one, but he's 40, I'm not going to make that person go take out a $15,000 loan on top of what they want to spend to go buy this horse that may or may not work just because he's bigger, fatter, shinier, fancier, can stop a little better. And then you go through that checklist, but a lot of the times once you've gotten to know somebody, you know how they ride and you kind of know how they think. And, some customers are you get my horse ready for me and, you warm it up and I want to get on it three horses out and I want to go show it. I want the enjoyment of showing. And when we're done, we're going to cool him out, wash him off and I'll going to go drink some beer and I'll see you tomorrow. And then I've got the other customers that thrive on the me dragging them out there at 3 o'clock in the morning and making them go through everything they need to go through and then go put that horse up and get it back out 45 minutes before they show it later in the day, trot it around, warm it up, and go show it and see if they can put together what they worked on early in the morning. Being able to match those horses up psychologically and pair them with people, that can get pretty interesting. I'm not going to lie and say I get it right every time, because I don't. And luckily, most of the time when I'm hauling customers up and down the road going to horse shows, I've been around them quite a bit at home, and I've gotten to watch them ride, and I see how they are, and, and I get to know them a little better really before we start going and showing. And I might take them to a few little horse shows just so they can kind of get their feet wet in my program and I can see how they are. And, and I don't mind. I don't mind if that customer is one of those that just wants to get on it, three horses out and go show it, or whether they're one that wants to come out and join me in the early hours of the morning when I'm riding mine. Some of them get a little grumpy because I'll stagger my customers when we go to the bigger events. I'll start riding at midnight. And I'll be like, okay, you're coming out at 1. I want to see you on your horse at 2:30, and then you on your horse at 3:30, and then last ones will be 4 or 5 o'clock, and then we're going to do chores, feed, breakfast. Some of them get a little grumpy because they have to come out at 1, but it's easier to stagger those people throughout the night and give them. I can ride one, they can ride theirs. If I've got 3 or 4 that I've got to ride overnight, plus help a bunch of people, it's a whole lot easier if I can stagger them through the night, because then I can actually spend some time working on my horses too.
That's pretty smart, though.
You have to spend time with a bunch of different people and learn how best to navigate the whole industry as a performance horse trainer, coach, whatever, because it's not just the feed them and ride them.
Right.
Right. It's the logistics of it. I mean, one year we took 32 horses to the Raynham Fraternity. That was a logistical nightmare.
I bet so. I was fixing to say. That's a lot of horses.
It is, and that was when we had, there were three horse trainers at Darling Ranch. There were three horse trainers, We each had an assistant. We each had two interns, you know, and running that place could be a nightmare. But you have to learn a lot of this stuff as you go and kind of like, you know, and that was for me one of those, I so enjoyed that time, that period of time when we were running that hard and we were that big. But also I was like, this isn't all encompassing. This isn't necessarily where I want to end up.
I wanted to be a little more one-on-one.
Right. And the thing is it's not just, it's managing the people, the staff that go with that, the customers, you know, appeasing everybody is never a good thing. It's never easy to do. And then just maintenance on your daily horse care, you know, what horses need, everything they need from nutrition to meds, to icing, to wrapping, to clay, to going to the spa, to this, that, the other. Is somebody delegated to do it? Have they done it? Did they check it off? Why, you know, there's so much goes on that you need somebody full time just managing everybody.
I was fixing to say, that's probably a full-time job, taking care of that many horses, just in that aspect of it.
You know, and it is. I mean, we had, at one point, we had 73 horses in training. And just dealing with the worming, the vet, the shoeing on a daily basis. You know, with 73 horses in training, my horse shoer was there 2 days a week.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, my vet, we had an on-site resident vet. I had him in the barn every day. And, you know, we always had something going on. So, you know, for me, part of that was I didn't want that because I felt like, I personally felt like a lot of the customers missed out on a lot of stuff. You know, so when we built our place here in Texas, we built 20 stalls. And Charlie Hutton had drilled it into me. Well, I worked for him. Don't build more stalls than you're willing to clean yourself, because you will clean them yourself. You know, the way our deal works here right now, and it works pretty well for us right now. I mean, I go out to the barn around 6:45 in the morning, and I start feeding. I feed everybody. I do meds. I empty and clean and refill water buckets on everybody in the barn. That takes me till about 7:45-ish. 8 o'clock, by which time my wife shows up in the barn, right around when I'm filling water buckets. And she, by that point, she's put the kids on the bus. They've done what they need to do. They've had breakfast, blah, blah, blah. She's cleaned up the kitchen in the house. She's come out. She starts cleaning the stalls. I drag the arena or I go to ride. If I'm lucky, she might saddle and wash for me. If not, I'm washing and saddling my own horses. You know, and then she's normally done cleaning the stalls by around 10:30 in the morning, 11 o'clock. And she might round pen a couple or saddle a couple, or she might come out to the arena and watch me ride a couple and be like, hey, that sucks. You need to fix that. And then she goes about her afternoon stuff, might mow some grass, whatever. I keep riding horses till really long. I guess what time was you messaged me this evening? 7 o'clock or so, we just literally just walked out of the barn.
Well, you just made me think of something. So about how long, I know this is going to be dependent on the horse, but on average, how long does it take to take a horse from, like, broke to do reining to be able to compete on average?
Okay, so as far as, I'll put it to you this way. I like to start all my coming 2 year olds in November, December, their yearling years, long yearlings.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be, I mean, average from start to go in the show pen and be broke, you're looking at pretty close to 2 years.
That's not that bad. That sounds decent.
You know, and some of them get there sooner. Some of them take a little longer. And a lot of it is horse dependent.
I was going to say it's going to be dependent on the horse. You know, it's definitely going to be dependent on the horse. But
you know, I mean, I'm, for me, like I've got, so this year I've got 4 3-year-olds in the barn that are for me to show. Three of them are above average, in my opinion. One of them, he's a nice horse. He's not really going to be much of a show horse this year, but next year I think he'll be really nice. He's a little bit slow to mature, mentally and physically, and clean up and fix it. I think if you want to do it right, you've got to allow yourself 2 years.
Well, that's what I was just fixing to ask you. Do you think it's hurtful to show them too early versus making sure they're more ready and showing them later?
No, I don't necessarily think it's I don't think it's detrimental in any way. You know, the part of the reason that I like to start mine a little early, and I say by starting them, I don't mean I'm riding them in November. Like, we're going to the round pen, we're sacking out, we're saddling, we're line driving, you know, we're doing 15 to 20 minutes worth of work a day, and I'm not climbing on them and trying to ride them.
Right.
I get a lot of groundwork done November and December, and then hopefully I've got them where I can ride them middle of January, coming into February. You know, so like now, this time of year, my 2-year-olds, I need to go to the round pen still Monday and maybe Tuesday and let them get the fresh off after the weekend. But Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I can put them in the cross ties, put a saddle on them, put the swim boots on, put their bridle on, walk out to the arena, step up on them, and they are not going to buck my ass off. You know, and I've got forwards, backwards, left, and right. We're not doing anything fancy. I mean, I've got two 2-year-olds right now that I got in right on time at the end of October, beginning of November, and I'm thinking probably next month I'll put slide plates on a couple of them because they're trying to stop. They're understanding the whoa. They know how to trot, stop, back up. You know, they're trying hard to figure it out. So, but what you know, the thing is that as you progress that horse, you're not just progressing him mentally, but you're building him up physically. You're building the muscle tone. You're building the stamina. You're building the strength to be able to begin to learn how to stop, to begin to learn how to turn around. You know, I'm one of those, I really believe you have to, in order to go show a horse, the horse has to get trained. Before he can get trained, he has to get broke. And there's only one way he's going to get broke, and that's by you getting on him and teaching him.
Yeah.
And, you know, and by being broke, I mean, you know, I can get him up stall, saddle him, put a snaffle bit on him, go out to the arena and step up on him, and he's going to wait till I ask him to walk off, and we can walk, we can trot, we can lope left and right. We're not worried about lead changes. We're not worried about stepping around. I'm worried about, does he go where I point him at desired speed?
Right.
Once I've got that to where he has a distinct understanding of that, well, then I can start to teach, and I can start to coach, and I can then start to get a read on that horse as to, you know, what kind of athlete he's going to be. The ones that really get you are the ones that you say, hey, I'm going to try something new today. Can you figure this out? And in 10 seconds, that thing has got it figured out. And he stands there and asks you, what's next? And you're like,
smart ones.
you're like, I really don't know. So I'm going to get off before I screw something up.
Well, and reiners are not, I mean, reiners, they have to be a little above regular physical fit. I mean, the reiners have to be really in phenomenal shape to do some of the stuff that they do.
They do, and I think a lot of the issues that come in are from horses not quite being strong enough to go do some things yet. Like, I spend a lot of time conditioning. You know, like old school conditioning, long trotting, you know, bend and flex them, but not just walk around and bend a little bit and off we go. Like, I might spend 10 minutes on some of my three-year-olds right now at a long trot, at an extended trot, trotting around the arena, trot circles, serpentines, you know, and working on stamina and stuff like that. And I might, you know, we're going to work up to a decent sweat every day. And the problem comes in, you have to balance this, because you can get a horse too fit to where you can't ride that sucker enough.
I didn't ever think about that.
Yeah. You know, if you've got one, like I've got one right now. He's Hollywood done it, gunner bred. Talented 3-year-old. But he is what I call bottomless. And if I got this thing, like, fighting fit, I don't know where we would end up. Because he'd never quit. Like, he won't quit. If you tell him, let's go gallop circles, he goes, okay. I mean, he's a little bit of a Forrest Gump. He just goes, okay, we'll gallop circles. I mean, this thing will gallop circles till he can't move. He has no quit to him. So if you get a horse like that too fit, you can't ride it down enough.
I see what you're saying.
And you've got to work the mental aspect of it versus the physical. Have them strong enough to be able to do their job, but have them where their brain is dialed in so that they understand that if they do it, they get to quit. And you've got to almost, those horses you have to teach to be lazy. And that's the reverse psychology in the training of it. You know, if you teach that horse to want to turn around, if you teach him that the turnaround, you know, so horses are fight or flight. As long as he's not fighting you, he's gonna try to evade you. Well, if you teach him the perfect place to evade you is the turnaround, he's always gonna go there. Wanting to turn around ultimately in the show pen. If you teach him, if you go to a certain position and he locks into that turnaround and you pitch him away and you make it like a game of hide and seek and he gets to win, he'll always go there. Same thing with teaching one to run and stop. If you teach that thing like it's a game of hide and seek, and if he runs down there, and I mean just flat drags his tail like a wormy dog, he gets to do nothing and be done. He's going to hunt that stop. He's going to hunt that lead change. He's going to hunt that turnaround. And that's the difference in getting one to want to do it. And then when they're wanting to do it, they're happy to do it rather than being pressured into it. A lot of times, if you've got to pressure one into it, it's either not strong enough to do it or it doesn't understand.
Right. And then it's going to be sloppy at the end. It's not going to end up being.
Right. Well, and you see, and you build resentment. A lot of the reining, you know, to create a soft horse, you have to be soft and you have to find a way to teach him soft, because the more you pull, the more you have to pull.
Yeah, we all want that.
You know, so that, and that resistance becomes later, like I was saying about these horses that are almost bottomless, that have no quit. That's kind of resistance. So you've got to find a way to train that out of them. And you can't train it out of them by making them go more.
Because the whole objective is, you know, you want them to want to stop. And if you've got a horse that won't stop, then you've got to figure out a workaround to get to that.
Right. Well, I mean, and here's the thing. You're dealing with 1,200 pounds of muscle. Do you really think if you get into a fight with him, you're going to win?
Right.
Do you really think there's anything you can do to that horse to make him do something?
No.
If push comes to shove, he's going to go, you're out. But you can't make him stop physically. But you can make him wish he had. You can change their thought processes. And that's all it's about is getting them to think in the right way. You know, I mean, I really admire these guys that do the rein cow horse, like do the snaffle bit fraternity.
Yeah.
It takes me 2 years to get one in the random pen. These guys are putting horses in the pen at Fort Worth and Snap 30. They're coming out of the herd. They're doing the fence work and they're doing the dry work, and they make it look cool as shit. And I'm like,
oh yeah, man.
And they're still a snaffle bit. And I'm like,
some of them fence, like those videos of them doing the running down the fence and working the cow and stuff like that. I'm like, holy cow.
Yes. You know, and I have the utmost admiration for those guys and respect for them, because they're training three disciplines and they're getting it done by September. September, I'm normally still beating my head against the wall.
Yeah, I mean, so I've ridden some. I've been, I guess, both fortunate and unfortunate enough to ride some that should never have been in the show pen.
For lack of a better word.
I've been given horses to go show because other people couldn't get them shown. I've been told to take horses to a horse show and not come home unless it wins money. You know, and I've ridden full siblings to horses that have won huge amounts of money, and they have been the most no count reigning horses you could ever hope for. I mean, they've just been awful. I've had full siblings that, you know, won 50,000, 60,000. Full brother comes along, little better bodied, better neck, looks like he's got better legs to him. You like watch him as he yelling, you're like, ooh, I'm gonna go wreck some shit with this one. You get him started, you get him riding around, and you are like, wow, you are useless. And they just can't do it. It's all down to the individual.
I was fixing to say, I know horses aren't like humans, but if you can kind of look at it in that perspective, you have some families where people have kids and you have, you know, exact opposites. You know, you have...
I got four kids and you can get four more different children. Yeah, I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Like, you see a lot of people, their ads, they'll say this, those type, like, full sibling to so-and-so and this and out of this and buy this and da-da-da-da-da. And I'm sure it does matter. But then again, it's like what you and I are sitting here thinking, you know, at the end of the day, it really just boils down to the horse.
It does. And honestly, I think the dam side has far more to do with it than the sire. You know, if you breed a good stud to a mare that did well, who was out of a mare that did well and produced others, in that, you know, if that mare herself had five showing horses that all did relatively well, and then if you breed that maternal side, I'm a strong believer in that. I mean, I think mare power is a thing.
Well, I've seen a lot of that come up over the last couple of years where it wasn't as much concentration on the mares before, but that really has come up a lot. I think a lot more people are seeing it in that light too.
And I think that's true. I mean, because, you know, when you think about, you know, horses like Wimpy's Little Step, God knows how many millions of dollars he's won as a sire now. But, you know, way back early on, you know, they were, you know, Wimpy Little Step, $5 million sire. But when you look at the amount of babies on the ground by that horse every year showing, he's going to get there. You know, when you've got 250 head of babies on the ground every year, The problem is that it brings the average down on the winnings. You know, so you average it out. At one point, I think, you know, and I'm not taking anything away from Wimpy. Wimpy was a fantastic horse. And as Ray, I've won a lot of money on babies by Wimpy Little Step. But, you know, at one point, I looked at the average offspring earnings, and it was like $2,700. But it was only that because there was so many. You know, when you're like, oh yeah, offspring won $6 million at that one point,
but you actually, then they do the average and they go, okay, well, there was 500 showing age babies. Well, that's where it comes from. So, you know, there are 50 at the 300,000, 400,000, 500,000. But then there were others down there that won nothing, $10, $20. You know, and the problem is they weren't necessarily bad horses. They just weren't as good as those better ones, and maybe they weren't placed as well. You know,
right.
when you think about it, as far as the reigning goes at NRHA, there were probably only maybe 40, 45 true level 4 open futurity horses every year. Yet there'll be 380 open futurity entries. And they're only going to take 30 to the finals. And those are going to be your true level 4 futurity finalists, open horses.
Right.
The problem is a lot of the big guys have a little bit of a monopoly on that, because the better horses are owned by the bigger owners, and they're in with the bigger guys that a lot of us just dream about riding.
Right.
You know, when Sean's got, you know, Sean's got 12 3-year-olds in his barn. Andrea's got God knows how many. Casey's got how many. Van Landingham's got how many. You know, Craig Schmerzel. All these guys, Jesse Beckley, they've all got a bunch of these good 3-year-olds. Those of us in the level two, lower level stuff, we're like, I think I've got a good level 3 horse. I'd like to really believe he could be a level 4 horse. But I'm just going to be happy if I keep him sound, sane, and hooked up enough, and my customer happy enough that I get this sucker to Oklahoma City in November.
Yeah.
And I stand a chance, because if I don't get to go, I don't stand any chance at all.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that I've never shown a reiner or any of that type of stuff, just kind of in and out. I've seen kind of the same big names, like you mentioned, or seem to be the ones that keep rolling around. And it would be cool to see another name pop up and be able to do what some of those guys do.
You know, it does happen. I mean, look at what, you know, the likes of Cole Price. You know, he won the level 1 fraternity, and then there he is. He's knocking on that door every single time. And there's a lot of guys out there in the level 2 and 3, the lower level stuff, that are getting close. They're getting close. And the likes of, you know, Luca Fapani now and Sam Flaherty, and some of these really younger guys coming up I've really spent the time learning their craft. I mean, I would love to go spend more time with the likes of Andrea and Sean, and I know that I know that if I pick up the phone and call and say, hey, can I come spend a week, we can make it happen. My problem is I have my own business and I have a family at home, and it's very difficult for me, on top of the 130 something days I'm gone out every year showing, to be gone more days for personal gain.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I kind of pick their brains a little bit as and when I can at horse shows. But it's the thrill of the chase, I guess. It's really what draws us to it. That, for me, I didn't want to get a real job.
Well, so now you work 24/7.
Yeah, and I don't get paid for it either.
That's like, I love it when I see people are like, I want to work for myself. Okay, well, you're going to be working not for yourself. You're going to work for everybody else, and it's going to be 24/7.
So I was talking to another horse trainer friend of mine, actually that might have been yesterday, and we were talking about family and history and stuff like that, and actually we were talking about what got us going, you know, in the horse deal, and he said he was in college, and all he could think about was riding horses in college, doing computer studies, and all he could think about was riding horses. So he quit college and he went to horse training school, and that was it. And I was like, yeah,
I just didn't want to get a real job, and I think actually it was partly out of spite that I became a horse trainer, because my family were pretty well hell-bent on me not being a horse trainer and wanted me to do something else and not be involved in the horse industry, that I decided I had to be involved in the horse industry.
And now look at you.
Yeah, I know, right? Don't stop chasing your stupid, stupid dreams. No. I had somebody ask me, we were at a horse show in Perry, Georgia. And this one lady kept kind of giving me the side eye for a few days. She'd been giving me weird looks. And I was like, this almost making me uncomfortable.
Right.
And
what's your problem, lady?
And I was like, I'm not going to lie. We had a very, very successful horse show at that horse show. I was lucky to get out of there without being lynched. We won. My assistant and I won everything. The customers we took. We won a lot, And we were there. I think we got there on the Wednesday, and we showed Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Finally, on the Saturday evening, we were just getting done. This one lady walked down my barn aisle there at the fairgrounds, and we were just getting finished up, getting ready to go to bed. I think it was around 5-6 o'clock. I had my assistant and an intern with us helping. She introduced herself. And, we stood and talked a minute. She goes, "I've been wanting to come talk to you all week." And I was like, "I kind of wondered why you would give me the damn side eye." And she goes, "Well, I was just very intimidated." And I was like, "I'm the least intimidating motherfucker I know." And she goes, "Well, no, you roll in here with these big, fat, fancy, shiny horses, and you win the Open, and your assistant wins the Rookie Pro and the Limited, and your non-pro wins, and then you go and win the Novice Horse, and you're third on another horse in the same class." And she's like, "I was just a little intimidated to come talk to you." I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" She's like, "Well, would you be willing to stay a little bit later on Sunday when the show gets done and give me a lesson?" And I was like, "Yeah, it don't bother me one bit." I was like, "I tell you what, if you don't care to get out of bed, come out here at 2 a.m. I guarantee you it'll just be me, you, and my assistant in that arena. And we'll run some paid warm-ups. And we'll get you through whatever problems you've got going on. I'll do my best to help you get shown on Sunday."
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You'd think I just gave this lady all of her Christmases at once. And I'm like, I don't know why you're that excited. I'm not that good. I'm just having a good horse show.
but you helped kind of break that, because I think, mine kind of comes from when I was showing, it was like people didn't talk to you. Like you trainers didn't talk to you. Horse riders didn't talk to you. It wasn't like that. And I think that's kind of because, like we were talking about earlier, all this information wasn't easily accessible back then, so people could be hushed. But now it's so accessible, it's kind of no excuse not to talk. But anyways, it's cool that you did that, because that does seem to lack a lot in the horse show world. I've had conversations with other people where they'll tell me they'll go to shows and events where it can feel so cold and people don't speak and it's so unwelcoming. And then they'll go to another event where it's like, people are like, "Hey, what's up? We're having a good time. Chill out, you know.
And I know this is going to sound really bad. If this goes out to your podcast, this might ruffle a few feathers. But that's why I don't go to quarter horse shows. I do not go to AQHA shows. I will qualify horses for the AQHA World Show, but I will do it at the NRHA events. Because the AQHA, going to an AQHA horse show is not as much fun as it used to be. It's not as much fun as I remember it being. Going to an NRHA event, all the reiners, for the most part, 95% of them, there's a couple of grumpy ones, but for the most part, 95% of them are pretty normal, happy people that will talk to you and will offer advice, give advice when asked, offer help. You walk down the barn aisle and say, "Hey,
Jimmy, can I borrow a set of reins? He'll take a set of reins off of a bridle and say, here, just give them back when you're done. You know, so for me, that whole side of it, there's a very big social aspect to it. And I find, you know, the reiners are very much like that. And I enjoy that. I enjoy being able to talk to everybody and say hi. And you know, some of them are shy. And sometimes I think that the guys that don't say a lot or are a little stoic and standoffish, I think actually they're a little more shy. I'm a very shy person, too.
You know, yeah, I can see that.
But, you know, going to the quarter horse shows, and I advocate to a lot of my customers, look, if you want to do the quarter horse deal, we'll try and qualify at the rein in events. And if you really want to go to the world show, we can go. But my thing is I can say, look, we can go spend $800-$900 going to a quarter horse show and showing in the age rein and junior rein and all ages rein and youth rein and amateur rein and whatever you want to go show in. We can go drive to wherever, go show in a quarter horse show. You're going to spend $800 to $1,200. And you're going to get a thanks for coming. Here's some points.
It's a good investment.
I was like, oh, you can let me take you to a rein. And you're going to spend similar amount of money. But I might be able to give you a return on that investment. Even if it's only $150, I might be able to get you a check back. You know, and it's even better when that customer wins that money back on their horse rather than I go win it back. You know, I think sometimes I still get excited. Like we were in Tulsa a couple of weeks ago, and I got excited. I showed one in the Derby. She was decent. She was pretty good, just not quite good enough in the Derby. It was pretty salty. I think I was like 5 places off of getting a check in the level 2. I'm like, she was a 215. I was like, I was happy with my horse. She was good. Just not quite good enough. I turned around. I showed her in the open 2 days later and was second on her. Won like $400. I was tickled to death. I mean, I was tickled to death. And my owner was happy, obviously. But what was better for me was I've been coaching a couple of young girls. And both in the youth. And their dad came to me and he said, look, there's a run for a million rookie qualifier here at this horse show. I said, yes. He's all right, there is. He goes, I want my girls to qualify. At which point I tipped my hat sideways on my head, scratched my head a little bit, was like, okay, I guess we're shifting focus. And because bearing in mind, these girls haven't been to very many horse shows, have been to even less horse shows with me. We've had some technical difficulties getting our horses shown, is the easiest way to put that. Where a lot of shit has gone wrong real fast. I got those kids ready 3 days. I put them in that. They both qualified for the rookie run for a million. For me, success was looking at those girls' faces when they marked 70 and a half, 71 and qualified. They hadn't marked above a 68 ever. And they got qualified, you know, and then they turn around the next day and they're top 5 in the youth and they get a paycheck out of it. You know, they go win $20, you know, and then I send them on their way. They went up to the Cactus Classic this week. Went with another horse trainer. I was like, yeah, not going. You guys want to go to Arizona, have fun. This is the bridle I would ride this horse in. Go do your thing. Well, they did it again out there. They were top 5 in their youth. That to me is being successful, because that's carrying on. And it means more to me, those guys getting a $10, $15, $20, $30 check showing than me going and winning $2,000, $3,000, $5,000.
Yeah.
You know, and because the thing is that those girls' parents, they can't there is no price that they will put on those girls going out there and having that much fun and then being able to qualify for something more like a run for a million. You know, that's that to me is a huge thing.
You're doing your job. If they're winning it with what you're teaching right. them and the investment that they're putting in you and what you're giving back to them, that's your result right there. I mean, that speaks volumes.
Right. It does. But it not just to the program that they're in, but to them as students.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because I can only coach somebody that's coachable. If you're not coachable,
this is true.
I can't help you. You know, I can sit there in a chair, or I can sit there in the middle of the arena on my horse, and I can tell you something till I am blue in the face. But if you, as a rider, are not understanding what I'm trying to get across, you're not going to be able to achieve it. Now, and here's the hard part from a coach aspect is trying to figure out whether that person is not understanding it, or whether they just don't care and they're just having fun.
Yeah, right. I can see that. Yeah.
Because I have some customers that they really don't care what I'm telling them about their turnaround or about the shoulders or about the chin or about their horse stepping forward in the stop or being a little crooked in the backup. They are just having a blast.
They're just excited to be out there.
They are just having fun, you know, and they're going to get off, they're going to watch their video, and they're going to go, hey, you see that? You see this? And you go, yeah. Can you fix that? Like, I can try. Can you fix that before I show again in 2 days? I can try. And you won't see them again until an hour before they need to saddle their horse 2 days later to go show. You know.
Well, those customers are you probably need a little bit of both type of customer to be able to.
You do, but what you don't want is the extreme version of that where they're out there riding their horse the night before. Now I've had this. This is personal experience. They're out there riding their horse the night before they show it in a fraternity, and you get somebody walk up to you, go, hey. You might want to go to the arena and see what's going on. So you go trotting out there to the arena, and you look out there, and sure enough, there's your customer on their 3-year-old, and it is leaping through the air, rearing up. And you're like, you're like, huh, he wasn't doing that 2 days ago. That's new.
What did you do, Bob?
And they look, they see you over there, and they step off. They come walking towards you. They hand you the rein. They go, yeah, fix this, son of a bitch. I got to show him tomorrow. They're like, well, what did you do? I don't know, but he won't turn left. I'll see you tomorrow.
I bet that is a challenge, but you've probably been doing it so long where you could probably already figure out what's going on.
Well, yeah, but it's sometimes nice to know what they've done. It's like, it's not a problem. It's not that big of a deal that you broke it, but I want to know how you broke it.
Yeah. Right. I don't know.
you got other ones. Like I had a lady at Memphis, Tennessee last fall. She didn't realize I'd snuck up there into the judge's chair and was sitting there watching. There was another trainer sitting beside me, and my customers just sitting there. They've all been fencing. So at the rain events, you know, they schedule the arena overnight. It might be 30 minutes circling, 30 minutes fencing, and then they're going to drag. And they'll drag every hour. Or it might be an hour circling and an hour fencing, and then they'll drag. So, you know, so the arena is pretty structured. And again, discipline factors back into this. But I snuck up there into the judge's chair. She thought I'd gone to go get another horse. And she's sitting there. She's on her phone, and she's talking to her friends. Now 25 minutes goes by, and I kind of looked at the trainer next to me. I was like, he hasn't realized that I'm sitting here yet. And she goes, no, she hasn't noticed you. I was like, I wonder how long it would be before she texts me or calls me and says, hey, you coming back? What's going on? We leave in a few more minutes and it quietens down your ear, so I yell across your ear. I was like, hey, Allison, sitting still will not achieve anything. And she looks up and she goes, oh, shit, I was supposed to be working. I'd given her stuff to do. I'd given her things to do. I was like, hey, while I'm gone, go do this. I'm like, come back, and she's sitting in the corner on her phone. I was like, good Lord, what am I doing to you guys?